Good afternoon and welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM with me, Richard Sanderson, and with Padre Greedy. Neil will be back next time, so I'm just stepping into the break to do the show this week. Little Atoms is a talk show which is rationalist, atheist and pro-science, and we're also trying to do our best to connect these things with the left. Our guest today is the comedian and celebrity blasphemer Stuart Lee. And I'm going to hand over to Padre Greedy, who's going to introduce him.
Hello, Stuart. Stuart is, he wants to tell you, a writer and comedian director, probably best known in the past couple of years for Jerry Springer the Opera. So we may as well go straight into it, considering this is the atheist stroke blasphemy show. What first led you to writing Jerry Springer?
Well, it wasn't my idea. It was the composer Richard Thomas, and he said he'd been sitting, which is a different Richard Thomas to the Resonance Richard Thomas, who was also
a composer. Make that clear, yeah.
Leads to no end of confusion, and also the former Happy Days cast member,
or the manager of the Fall.
Oh, the manager of the Fall. Yeah, there's a lot of Richard Thomas. Yeah, anyway, Richard had been watching. He'd been writing opera, comic operas, and one night he said he was watching Jerry Springer the Opera, and he looked at Jerry Springer on television, the chat show, and he said, in a nutshell, he said, it's a load of fat people shouting at one another, and you can't understand what they're saying, and that's the same as an opera. And I think what he saw in it was the same kind of high drama and passions that you get in classical opera, but kind of contextualised in a way that was easy to understand. And the other great thing about it is that it misses out all the kind of woolly plot setups that you get in opera and music theatre, in as much as you don't have to have a kind of lead-in to someone's emotional trauma, because there's a man saying, so what's your name and what's your problem? You know, so you're straight in. Mm-hmm. And the more we thought about it, he kind of got the whole kind of first half idea of it being like an episode of the talk show together. And then for a second half, we wanted to scale it up and make it much more sort of epic. And so we decided to replay all the kind of themes that you have in the first half on the scale of a kind of proper classical opera, you know, with religious themes. Kind of making the point that when you look at ordinary people on an American talk show, you're supposed to... There's a part of you that finds their kind of... the positions they've got themselves into ridiculous. But a lot of the kind of... stress points of the relationships are the same as you have in classical myths or in religious myths and whatever. So it seemed like the perfect thing to do. And never at any point did we anticipate it becoming the focus of the sort of campaign it had against it.
Yes, that's something I meant to ask. I mean, was there ever any point, even writing, where you thought, oh, this is going to get a few people's backs up, or there will be protests?
There were two points writing it where we caught our own breath, you know, at a couple of the lines. Mm-hmm. But then we thought about them, and they seemed to make sense. One was where Jesus was a chat show guest, and Richard had written all the devils in the in hell, trying to ridicule him in a kind of playground way by saying that he was gay, and then he says, "Actually, I'm a bit gay," which sounds kind of puerile, but the timing of it was really great. It had this lovely open sort of space where everyone realised what he was going to say, and the guy Wills Morgan, who's a singer, did it really well. And then we thought about that, and we thought, well, he is supposed to embody, you know, all human experience, and so it doesn't really matter. And the other bit, which was harder, was in the first half there was a woman, an old woman, and the implication was that her daughter, who she hated, who'd become a pole dancer, was conceived, you know, the line was something like, some are descended from angels, some are descended from apes, some are the result of romantic love, others the result of rapes. And then in the second half, when Mary came on, we had the crowd shouting "raped by an angel" at her, which was to tie her in with the same character in the first half of the kind of suffering mother, but also just to show that if you choose to look at the myth of the virgin birth in a different way, mm-hmm. it's not unlike a Jerry Springer plotline. Here's this teenage mother who would have been, you know, 12 or 13 by Old Testament standards, trying to explain this this immaculate conception, you know. And also, I talked about this on Channel 4, and a lot of the people on religious rights seem to think I was being deliberately provocative, but I wasn't. I mean, if you accept that the reason that that's in the New Testament is because it has a relationship with pagan myths about conception from God, so much of the New Testament is as it is because it builds on existing pagan mm-hmm. ideas, then it's not a controversial idea. But if you accept the New Testament as a literal account of actual events, then it is a controversial idea to contextualise that within the sort of ongoing framework of mythology. So they were the two bits that we thought might get in trouble. But the other thing you have to understand, so I'll stop in a sec, is that it was a little fringe show at Battersea Arts Centre, and you never anticipated it really being seen by the sort of people that would accidentally or willfully get the wrong end of the stick.
Yeah.
Now we've sort of wound it back to the origins of it. I was curious as to whether, I mean, was it, because it's a very sweary show, I think we should say, and it's extremely funny, but was the swearing sort of always going to be integral to it?
Richard Thomas swears a lot in conversation. That's Battersea Arts Centre National Theatre Richard Thomas, not the resident Richard Thomas. But, and what he said about the swearing was that when you watch Jerry Spring on television, the swearing's bleeped out, you miss two things, right? Well, three things, really. One is that you're already guilty for watching it, so why do they try and soften it? You're already implicated in the sin of watching it.
It's a bit like Asterix is in the in the sun or the mirror.
You know, the second thing is that you miss the fact that what's interesting and moving about those kind of American talk shows, if you can look at them a different way, is that people want to express their feelings, but the passion and the lack of vocabulary means that always the fallback position is four-letter words. Mm. The other thing is the simple poetry of swearing. And, you know, without wishing to...
It is big and clever.
You know, the Irish make it. It is big and clever. And it's also... It's basically rhythmical, and music's about rhythm. And, you know, Richard found that he could get all the sentences that he wanted in it to fit the right rhythmical structures by throwing in swear words. And the F word, for example, can be one syllable, two syllable, three syllable. There's so many things you can do with it. And it was rhythmically great. And again, that was never a problem. I mean, it was The people that campaigned against it said there were 6,000 swear words in it. There were 176 when we counted. In the end, we were forced to go through and count.
But there is one, of course, memorable. There's one, the C word, I think, which virtually has an aria to
itself. The C word has an aria. Now, that aria at the National Theatre used to get a standing ovation.
And again, very well sung.
It was about context. It was about the fun of putting this stupid thing in the temple of culture. And I think it may be that part of the fun of that was lost when it was broadcast on television, which is where all the protests started, because the context was different. And this is an interesting thing about the whole debate that we've been inadvertently and unintentionally caught up in about what is offensive, is that offence is not just about the words and the ideas, it's about the context and the intent, you know, and those things are either deliberately or rather stupidly not taken into consideration by the people that came out against it.
The reason I brought up the swearing in particular was because I wondered whether, if you hadn't had the swearing, whether and just kept the basic plot, which involved Jesus and everything, whether it would have made anywhere near as much an impact with the people that objected to it. Well, because there is they do tend to go hand in hand, that they don't like swearing very much at all.
Well, I don't think anyone that saw it really objected to the swear. I mean, I don't meet many people that saw it that objected to it. You meet people that saw it didn't like it or didn't think it was very good, but you don't meet many people that saw it that thought it shouldn't be on or found it offensive. And in fact, the kind of leader of the opposition, Stephen Green, a Christian Voice, still hasn't seen it, but says that you don't need to step in dog shit to know that it smells.
Did he quite phrase it like that?
He did say that, so I'm sorry if you can't say that. He did say that, which is a really funny thing to say. But also illogical, because if you were the first person to ever see dog's droppings, you may need to investigate them. Certainly before waging a huge campaign against them. You need to more about them. But yeah, I think, you know, it was probably more difficult for people to... It was probably more difficult for ambivalent people to defend because of the level of swearing in it. But the problem with freedom of speech, you know, is it's not negotiable. And if you believe in it as an idea, unfortunately, you do find yourself having to defend things you don't necessarily like or agree with. And that wasn't something I'd given any thought to really before this. And I've found it sometimes I come unstuck talking about the show because I wasn't someone that had formulated a policy about this idea before I suddenly found myself being asked as if I were an authority on it.
At what point did it go ballistic? Because, I mean, the show had been trundling around for a fair while before all of a sudden it was sort of front page news.
Well, the first little run of it, when it was kind of half an hour, was at Battersea Arts Centre in about April 2001. And then I came on board after that and helped kind of plot it out and direct it. And it was sort of finished after a succession of kind of odd workshop performances at Battersea Arts Centre. It was kind of finished in about February 2003 when it opened at the National Theatre. And then it ran until January 2005 without any problems. So basically it was on in some form for 4 years without any criticism. And actually, people forget, with rather favourable reviews from Catholic Herald and Church Times. And then when it was announced that it was going on television, that's when... the Christian right found out about it. But I think what they were looking for was a way of piggybacking their concerns into the public eye. And I think that the opera was a very convenient thing to do that with, because the way it was described didn't have a tremendous amount to do what was actually in it. And, you know, subsequently, Christian Voice have campaigned against it alongside the BNP in some places. And I think they're both people that have very specific agendas that that you could sort of seem to tie in with this, which was obviously written, produced, and performed by homosexuals and people with a different cultural outlook. So I think it became a bit of a football, really.
I see. It's interesting, and I think maybe just slightly clarifying, I guess, legal action. The Christian Voice and BNP didn't actually get together on this. BNP kind of bandwagoned onto Christian Voice,
yeah,
didn't they?
Yeah, it wasn't that.
Stephen Green's a lot of things, but he's not a fascist. Well, he's not a racist. He's a different type of fascist,
When they were asked in Plymouth about were they concerned that the BNP were campaigning against it as well, he said that the political persuasions of a protester weren't his concern. Mm-hmm. The main thing was that they were trying to get it off.
I do remember seeing him somewhere else saying that, you know, writing some big thing about racism isn't, you know, amenable to God or whatever, yeah, or something like that. I mean, yeah, he did attempt to distance himself slightly.
There's that problematic area where, you know, where racism crosses over with a dislike of cultures that are specific to different ethnicities.
Well, yes.
You know,
mm.
And if you're saying that all Muslims are going to hell, which he does, then there's, you know, obviously the idea exists in isolation from their race, but that's something that the BNP are going to pick up on.
Yes, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
I'm interested in the idea of context that you brought up. That there's one thing that you can, things you can say in a stand-up show in a small club that you can't say in a theatre, and then there's things you can do in a small opera in a Battersea Arts Club that you can't say in a theatre.
Yeah.
Is there an element of hypocrisy, both on maybe our part as free speech, we're saying, like when it gets into national level, kind of, that's a bit harsh, and as well on the side of the protesters?
There is, definitely. Yeah. I mean, I'm put my hand up to that, you know. I mean, it's in its worst form, I suppose, that idea is that, you know, it's like the prosecutors in the Lady Chatterley case saying, would you like your wives and servants to read it?
That's obviously precisely right, what we're talking about.
And also the thing that the BFI do, or certainly did under the guy before now, which was that they would let things through in subtitled art films that they wouldn't in mainstream films, because they were somehow, in a kind of patriarchal way, less concerned that the viewers of subtitled art films would act on the would act on the bad example offered to them. For me, context is a practical thing. You know, as a result of after being involved in all this fuss about Jerry Springer the Opera, I wrote a stand-up show about this idea of kind of what is blasphemy, which ended with a long half-hour sort of scatological encounter with Jesus, which I knew I was only going to be doing to people that were going to be going to 100-seater rooms in fringe theatres.
Yeah.
And there was no way that anyone that wasn't going to understand it would find it. So I was able to cut through to the chase of the ideas a lot more quickly and not worry about being misunderstood. But on a practical level, it's just not... It's not... professionally, you know, the fuss about Jerry Springer the Opera going on TV meant that it's never going to break even, you know, and you're not really ever going to see any money for it. And I mean, we've got a bit over the time, but kind of practical payouts, but the point where royalties kick in and that kind of thing, and it's I already subsidise a lot of what I do by writing for papers and things like that, and to be in a position where you're ending up doing other jobs to subsidise a multi-Olivier award-winning piece of theatre becomes
also,
just
bizarre. It's interesting because it negates that, you know, the cliche of, oh, well, you know, they're only being shocking to make money. So you actually prove the reverse in a way.
Yeah, I mean, this is a weird thing where, you know, people go, how's it going? You go, oh, it's been banned in so-and-so and you can't perform it here and there. Leicester are thinking about pulling it, and people go, well, there's no such thing as bad publicity. But there is, if it prevents a thing being performed. In some towns, the when we were trying to tour it, there were certain bed and breakfasts that wouldn't let people that were involved in the show stay there because they thought that they must be... So on a practical
it's
level,
extraordinary. I mean,
it became very difficult.
It sounds like the kind of weird moral panic that was happening in the Sex Pistols tour in 77.
Yeah.
You picture the sort of the people standing outside the places saying, don't go in there, don't let your children in there.
Yeah, well, it was like that. And those people were there singing hymns. Sometimes it was funny, there were 5 or 10 of them. And sometimes it was very frightening in Newcastle, Liverpool, where there were 1,000. And there's 1,000 people, and some of them are 5 or 6-year-olds, giving out those American fundamental Christian comic books about gays going to hell. And it's a really actually upsetting thing to see. And it wasn't something that I enjoyed being involved in at all. And also, there's no pleasure in... It happened once I was put on a panel against my better judgment by Channel 4 with Stephen Green. And there's no honour in it. There's no pleasure in that because you can't... It's quite distressing. It's like seeing an animal that's been wired wrong. You know, you can't kind of get through.
Yeah.
The reason wasn't going to work.
No.
Yeah.
And also going around the country, again, when we tried to tour it, the producers thought, not unreasonably, that it would be a good idea to go and do, at the request of a lot of the theatres, little panel discussions in different towns. And a lot of them were very ugly and distressing. And, you know, as an atheist, I don't bear any malice towards religious people. I just don't want my life dictated by them. But it's difficult it takes some effort of will to maintain that position when they have said such insane things to you, you know, and when you've seen them in an almost sexual frenzy of hatred, you know, it's really bizarre.
So what really is your impression now of the English religious right? I mean, it's a term that still sounds odd to me.
It does, doesn't it?
And I was talking... Oh, well, I went to a meeting recently in which this was being discussed, and the chap from The Guardian, Padre will probably be able to remind me of his name.
Stephen Bates.
Stephen Bates from The Guardian was saying... He was talking specifically about Green and Christian Voice, and was saying, you know, they're tiny.
They're still
absolutely tiny in this.
Well,
they punch
tiny.
Above their weight to a certain extent.
They are tiny, but they could mobilise 1,000 people in major cities, although in the early parts of our attempt to tour the show, they did make the classic Hitler-Napoleon mistake of fighting on two fronts, where they sent a lot of their forces to protest Romans in Britain at West Yorkshire Playhouse, which split the vote somewhat.
We should have got together and had a blaspheming double bill.
there's not many of them. But but the other problem, of course, that happened at the time, which gave extra weight to their case, was in between us trying to set the tour up, which was the start of 2005, and it finally getting underway in February 2006, having lost half the venues and a lot of the funding, that incitement to religious hatred bill was floating around, and it was uncertain as to whether that would be implicated, and the Christian Voice and Christian Institute were able to give venues the impression that they might actually be prosecuted for staging it. And to be honest, if that bill hadn't been lost by one vote, they would have been able to do that, because the wording of it was so vague that it would be left to the discretion of the investigating officer on the scene to say that the show should be closed down while it was investigated through the proper channels, which would make staging anything financially impossible, because you couldn't get the insurance to cover that risk. You know,
that was quite scary, that bill at the time, wasn't it? Because, I mean, there were some people saying, well, you know, people have been a bit ridiculous about it, that comedians aren't going to be prosecuted, but nobody really knew where it was going to go. And what was perhaps most peculiar was that just about everybody I met thought it was a bad idea, whether they were, you know...
Oh, yeah.
I think Christian Voice thought it was a bad idea, because they thought they would get prosecuted.
Well, Christian Voice were very worried that they weren't going to be able to stand around saying Muslims are going to hell. So, you know, and of course Green's just been banged up for taking gays are going to hell leaflets to a gay parade, which he obviously shouldn't be. It just seems like it's a stupid, inflammatory thing to do. But you can't do that to someone, you know. And also, it's not fair on whoever you have to share a cell with. You know? But yeah, I mean, that bill was weird. I mean, I think that the thinking behind it was somewhere along the line, somebody had thought the far right are going to be able to exploit the religious sensibilities of ethnic minorities as a way to bash them. So let's protect that. But the two things, as we said earlier, are separable. You know, one's something genes you inherit, and the other is, even if it's cultural, still there's some degree of choice in it, or it's a philosophy and a state of mind.
Plus, there are laws against hate speech anyway.
There are, which, interesting enough, Green tried to exploit when the police put out an internal document recently, an advert saying, you know, what are we going to do about educating people?
Yeah.
75% of homophobic attacks have a religious motivation, and I think Green managed to get that pulled, saying that was faith hate.
Yeah,
to say that, even though it had basis in fact. So it's an interesting, you know...
Well, they
problem.
All bundled in on that one. The Democratic Unionist Party, and everyone happily jumped on that one.
Yeah,
though, as you say, it was fact.
Mm. I heard for the first time the expression Christianophobic the other day. Has that been levelled against you?
Well, the whole... I mean, I am about to marry a Catholic, right? So I am not...
Is that just so you get the nice service?
Just so I can get the nice service. And it's to try and get everyone off my back. I've never met...
Those wafers are tasty.
You know, so it's obviously not... that's not a position that I... What I did find... Yeah, it was levelled against you, but you have to be very careful. I mean, about 3 or 4 years ago, I remember doing... I was one of about 50 people, like, vox popped by The Independent, about what you think about this impending legislation. Yeah. And, you know, do you think comedy can incite religious hatred? And I said, one would like to think so. That would be great. But it's not possible because... and I can't remember, went on to qualify it, you know. But I said, there will always be some kind of clash, because ultimately comedy is about questioning things, whereas religious fundamentalism is about a set of certainties. Now, you can tell I was being slightly facetious because I said one would like to think so, which is like a highfalutin way of saying it. And then I qualified it with this following statement. But that was reduced to a picture of me on leaflets that were distributed everywhere saying that I was a member of the National Secular Society, which I wasn't, and I'm fully intend to join now. And and underneath there was this quote saying, Stuart Lee has said, one would like to think religion could incite religious hatred. But with the but it can't and why bit removed. Well, So what I found myself doing over the last 18 months was trying to speak in complete sentences without any sub-clauses, not use any degree of irony, which then basically is everything that you kind of don't do as a writer, really.
Well, that's the chilling effect, really.
That's what they talked about, the chilling effect. And the chilling effect was that you found yourself terrified of being misunderstood. And I just had a very unprofessional exchange with a reviewer in The Observer who'd given a lukewarm review to...
I was actually going to bring that up after the break. Give you right to reply on that.
And I realised what it was really about was I felt he'd taken something I'd said in the Today programme 18 months ago out of context and used it in relation to this programme. And I found his email and flew off the handle because he said, oh, you have to be more used to criticism if you're going to write things. And it wasn't about that. It was about this terrible pathological fear I now have of being, of having something you've said snipped out.
Yeah.
And of course this happened with the opera, you know, you can't take a line out of it. Like a lot of the leaflets had this line where the devil says that God is a fascist tyrant on high. And they said that this was the view of the show. And it's actually a line from Paradise Lost. And anyway,
the line of the devil, yeah.
The devil would think that, right? And it's also Paradise Lost as much as it's analogous with Cromwell's relationship with Charles I, you know. Yeah. And so, which is kind of what that's about. It just seemed, I'm so nervous about this, because you find yourself doing it. You know, you do it when you talk about something. You say, oh, they said this, and you don't give the whole backstory, you know.
Yeah. Okay, shall we take a break? Okay. Now maybe we'll give you that promised right to reply, and we'll explain that a little bit, because I was curious to see how you might react to that. Yeah. I thought, Stuart, as you are a huge fan of The Fall, I'd bring something Fall related in.
Great.
But I wanted to get something that you might not have heard.
This is
Richard of Hume and his version of Paintwork.
Oh, smash it.
So let's have a listen to this.
Formation really late. Main sequence stars are no good for making carbon in this way. Giant red stars. Interest in suits, grew talent, everyone clenched, plants, sorrow. Formation really late, they think good stars and not.
And then I woke up. And I decided to recommence my diary. And then I read Paula Yates on Vision Mopeds. And then I found out we were not going to Italy. And Mater Mum said, those Continentals are little monkeys. And yesterday we had liver and sausage over. And sometimes they say, hey Mark, you're spoiling all the paintwork. And sometimes they say, your thumbprints are on the paintwork. Distractors, post-doctors, behind,
trace
come
paper,
in.
Skull,
and sometimes they say, hey Mark, your thumbprints are on
really
the paintwork.
Main sequence stars are no good for making carbon in this way. Giant red stars. Distractors, post-doctors, behind, come in, dressed in suits. Grow talents, everyone clenched. Plants, sorrow.
Thank you. But sometimes I feel like saying, this is bloody Newark, or some drive-in slack place in Breda or in Cologne. And with the shirt on, sun in vicinity, as if I hadn't done 10 months service in the USA on media guts. And sometimes they say,
he had a bloody nose.
Sometimes they say, hey Mark, you're spoiling all the paintwork. Sometimes I say, hey Mark, you're spoiling all the paintwork. And sometimes they say, hey Rich, you're spoiling Mark's paintwork. The end shoes or warehouse shoe, you got cheap new one, the target is too yahoo. And I think if I'd wanted to live in Holland, and if I'd wanted to be lived in, I'd have packed up and pissed off when I was 16. Right, that was Richard of Hume and his version of the Falls paintwork. I hope you enjoyed that.
That was great. That was brilliant. Better than their own version.
I'm not too sure about that. So, Stuart, yeah, just before we broke there, we mentioned. It would be enough to call it a spat. I love the word spat.
Well, the problem is, historically, writers and commentators on things would have had to write letters to each other, and it would become a very eloquent conversation that would then be put in a book hundreds of years later. Oh, look what Johnson said to so-and-so. Mm. Now, you find someone's email and you go, what are you talking about? So it wasn't very dignified, no.
Okay, so
my correspondence with the Observer reviewer, no.
No, so I'll get the background if we can. If you could tell us a little bit, because I'm afraid I did miss it, the blasphemy programme you did on Channel 5.
I got asked to do a programme Channel 5 about... which I should stress was part of a series that was supposed to be, they were called Authored Polemics. So the idea was that you didn't have to worry too much about balance, which was kind of refreshing, having spent 6 months going around the country trying to equivocate on these panels with representatives of all different aggrieved faiths. It was nice to not have to worry about that. So it was. When I left the edit, it was called New Puritans, but Channel 5 changed it to Stuart Lee Says What's Wrong with Blasphemy, which isn't something I'd
somewhat
say.
Somewhat less poetic.
Somewhat less poetic, yeah. It was basically, I went round and I talked to lots of different people about what they thought about religious censorship. And I talked to what I thought was quite a good spread, you know. No one from Christian Voice would appear. But I did find a nice vicar and theology lecturer from Winchester, and a couple of people like from, you know, from the humanist groups like Polly Toynbee. And Alan Moore, the comic book writer, he was great and was happy to talk about how he worships a 2nd century BC glove puppet of a snake and feels that his religion should be open to ridicule, which was great. But the bit that, yeah, the bit you were talking about that got a bad review was I was in conversation with Polly Toynbee and we started talking about the Danish cartoons of Muhammad that were out, I think it was last year.
Yeah, it was.
And I said that it was harder to defend them because they weren't very good. And then the reviewer said that that I was an idiot if I thought that improved penmanship, if the turbans had been drawn better, there wouldn't have been complaints or something.
Yeah. He says it was the news value of the cartoons. They were supposed to be the cause of international riots and a boycott of Danish goods that was the vital point. Yeah. The idea that if the cartoonists had demonstrated better draftsmanship, their newspapers would have rushed to publish them is an absurd fallacy that even the Bible and the Quran would struggle to rival.
Yeah. Well, this is partly relevant to what we were talking about earlier about, you know, philosophically, you find yourself, after 18 months of this, you find yourself in a position where you realise that the only position on freedom of speech can be that it's absolute. Mm-hmm. But then as a writer, you obviously allow an aesthetic sensibility to colour how you feel about that. Now, the journalist for The Observer assumed that I hadn't seen those cartoons, but I had, and I saw them under very funny circumstances in retrospect, which was I was invited to comment on those cartoons on the Today Prague on Radio 4, and I arrived and sat in a room waiting to go on, looking at the cartoons, and then the head of the then the chief rabbi of Britain came in, and then the bloke who does Thought for the Day came in, a Christian bloke, and then the bloke
does a joke comment.
And then the bloke from the British Muslim Council came in.
You in a darkened room.
Well, I was sitting in the corner. I felt like I'm the bad guy, you know. And then the rabbi stood up and embraced the Muslim and said, "How can we possibly rectify this terrible wrong that has been done to your people?" And I thought, oh, God, this isn't going to be a very balanced discussion, you know. But the interesting thing about cartoons is that there were eight. What happened in Denmark was there was a children's book. There was a series of children's books about all the faiths of the world. And they couldn't find anyone to illustrate the one about Islam because there's a historical taboo about drawing the prophet. Mm. So the paper's response to this was, send us your cartoons of Muhammad. Now, one of them was a children's book style illustration of him crossing a desert on a donkey. One of them was there were three or four that satirised in quite sophisticated ways the kind of devil's advocate position taken by the paper in doing this.
There was one quite striking one I remember, which was the a man drawing a picture, presumably of Muhammad, and him nervously looking over his shoulder as he did it.
And then there were two or three that did the normal gags about Islamic extremists. One of them being a load of suicide bombers are turning up in heaven, and Muhammad's coming out and he's going, "Turn back, lads, we've run out of virgins right now." That's kind of, you know, working men's club comic joke. And what I meant when I said that it was difficult to defend them artistically was, the interesting thing about that is you can make that joke without having to break the taboo of representing Muhammad. In fact, you could have had a sign up saying "run out of virgins" or whatever, or, you know. So there would have been loads of ways of getting that idea across without stepping on the landmine of this historic taboo of representing the prophet. So artistically, I'm thinking, oh, you could have had some real fun with that. Obviously, now, dealing in terms of kind of absolutes. You think, well, they should be allowed to do it anyway. But I don't think that that is a good enough joke to counterweight the stumbling in to that taboo. And the other point I made that he misrepresented me on was that I think there is a difference between having fun with the image of Christ and having fun with the image of Muhammad. And that difference is that there's a 2,000-year Western tradition of using images of Jesus to represent pretty much everything.
Yeah.
You know, and even there are mystery plays still in rep, you know, in York every year, mm-hmm. which are basically knockabout burlesque comedies, which were only able to get funding or be allowed to perform in medieval times if they appeared to have some religious, you know, context. But they're basically like carry-on films about shepherds, you know, or horror films about the devil, but at the end someone comes out and says a kind of wise statement and God's in it or whatever. So I think in the West we're a lot more comfortable with this idea of a mutable image of Jesus, and, you know, so many people have used it to different things. It's on T-shirts, it's everywhere. And now, even though there are some areas of Islam where the Prophet is represented, which is kind of conveniently glossed over, I think it is kind of more artistically significant to draw him. You know what I mean? I think if you're going to satirise something or write about it, yeah, it's best to kind of engage with it on its own terms, which is why Spinal Tap's really funny, because it's obviously done by people that know about 80s soft metal, you know, whereas Dead Ringers doing the same thing would be rubbish because they never have a feel for anything that they're talking about. But the other thing about that is that irrespective of that, the cartoons were used by one particular Islamic cleric to stir up trouble.
Yeah.
And one of the ones that he took over to Iran wasn't even from that set of cartoons. It was of a guy being intimate with a pig, and he happened to have a beard. And I think it was some kind of joke about some farming minister or something in Denmark.
As far as I recall, the pig one was someone from some tiny village in... There was one, and maybe there was separate, but there was someone from a tiny village in France,
right,
which, as part of its annual festival, has a pig lookalike contest.
Right. Well, because the guy had a beard, they were able to make out this was
a pig's nose on
a cartoon of Muhammad, yeah. and you know, obviously bringing pigs in. But I think I think it is more complicated. Also, I'd argue in favour of a certain... again, hypocritical double standard, in as much as in Britain today, certainly when we were talking about this on the Today programme, a lot of political power, explicit political power, is held by people from the Christian church, you know, in the House of Lords, the House of Commons, in tax breaks, in the fact that the blasphemy law only covers them or whatever, and financially they own huge amounts of land. So And Ian Hislop, when Goodness Gracious Me did a sketch about the Church of England, said, oh, everyone's always picking on the poor little Church of England. It's not the poor little Church of England. It's an enormously wealthy, financial, politically powerful body, you know. Whereas I would have said 18 months ago, a year ago, that it doing something about Islam is very different, because British Muslims have every reason to feel put upon, or certainly did a year ago when their mosques were getting firebombed after 9/11 and whatever. Now, that's different now after 7/7, you know, and I think that we do need to engage really dramatically and stop pussyfooting around and say that, like, you can't allow religion to legitimise violence, and you can't allow it to be interpreted to do so. And if it is a religion that legitimises violence, it needs to be stopped.
And it needs to be discussed.
And needs to be discussed without fear. And so,
yeah.
You know, but. But and also, obviously, it was totally wrong to put a fatwa out on those cartoonists. But I do think that it is better if you can understand a subject you're making fun of. And I think if they'd understood more about it, they would have perhaps been able to have more fun with the fact that you're not allowed to show the Prophet. I mean, how about a set of cartoons in which he's not even shown? Some of them did do that, you know. But now I tend to think, forget it. Just do it. You know. I mean. But I think in the program, the second half of that argument either was edited out or didn't make it, or was you know, ignored. But I mean, it is. It's difficult. It's difficult when again. It's the weird thing about drama and art and theatre and literature and poetry and music and whatever is, often it's about vagueness of meaning and duality of meaning. And the reason that good art doesn't square up alongside fundamentalism is because that's about fundamentals. And I think it's a shame when in the defence of art you end up occupying a similarly absolute position. You know, it's sort of, inevitably you do, but it's just kind of weird. It makes you as bad as them in a way, I think. Mm. You know?
I think, I mean, we are sadly looking at, because I feel this myself, that there's an awful polarisation that we're all getting sucked into for some, where you do become so repelled by one side's reaction that you tend to go completely the other way and say, actually, so do you anyway. If that's how you're going to behave, I'm going to go off and do this.
So, Stuart, we've ascertained now fairly certainly that you're an atheist. And I'm curious as to whether you always were, or whether you had the sort of, the opposite to the blinding light conversion.
I had a road away from Damascus experience. I never gave it much thought as a child. Then when I was about, 10, 11, 12, I kind of...
I was a teenager. Is there any background or...?
I was in a Church of England choir from about the age of 6 to about the age of 11, 12. Now, looking back on it, I sometimes thought, why was I in a Church of England choir? And the reason I was in a Church of England choir is because my mum, as a single-parent family, in an area where the schools weren't very good, was playing that numbers game that people do, where I ended up joining the Church of England Cubs and the Church of England Choir, and I ended up getting into the Church of England Junior School, which was had so much more resources and everything than the one on the estate where I would have gone to. And I'm really grateful to that. I'm really grateful she did it. And I'm also grateful because I really enjoyed the 5 or 6 years in a choir. I was never a very good singer, but I really like knowing my way around all the Bible stories and quotes and hymns that are the kind of historical cornerstone of British culture. I think
exactly.
Really,
I mean, there's a kind of foolish atheism, I think, sometimes. Yeah. It just sort of says, well, this is all rubbish, which means you then have to discount, Bach.
Yeah, and like the most fantastic poetry and imagery and art.
Exactly.
And, it's great. But and then alongside that, when I was a teenager, I was kind of on the fringes of that mid-80s kind of charismatic Christianity thing that kind of kicked off alongside the Greenbelt Festival when U2 used to play it and whatever, and then we were kind of thinking, this might be all right. And I went to a few of those meetings, and when it started to unravel was when you'd play devil's advocate with these guys and try and nail them on the gay issue, which seems to occupy a huge amount of space in kind of evangelical Christian thought. I mean, there's a lot of things it says not to do in the Bible, and one of them is to not have any money, ever. But that seems to be conveniently ignored, and we mainly concentrate on whether or not the thing in Leviticus about not lying down with a man means not having sex with him or not. And I think the reason when I thought this isn't worth it, the point I thought this isn't worth it was when I was a student, and Clause 28 was being brought in by Michael Howard, which was an attempt to reduce any funding for any art with a gay theme or whatever, and all of us as students wanted to go and protest against that for one reason or another, even like right-wing libertarian groups would, except for the student union, student Christian groups. And my move away from religion was initially a political one, where I thought human rights are more important than religious rights, and from that the whole belief thing unraveled. But I do still have a romantic, sentimental relationship with it, and it's informed a lot of things I've worked on, and it will continue to do so. And I hate the idea of throwing the baby out with the bathwater. You know, I think that, and I'd love to see. I think that the move towards religious schools, that with Blair saying we need more and more, is really bad. But I do think, conversely, there should be more teaching about religious themes in school, so that when kids are 5 and 6 and they're friends with other little kids from all different backgrounds, they have to realise that somewhere along the line a choice has been made rather than something is absolutely true. And I think the whole thing would make more sense to them if they were able to learn that alongside each other.
It's perhaps quite interesting that you've sort of, it seems to be anyway, that you've survived a period in which you could well have had an extremely jaundiced view of Christianity, because I imagine you've been constantly put up against the Philip Greens of this world, who are to put it mildly, not really representative of the vast amount of Christians in this country.
You know, there were religious people in the show. There's a great actress in her 60s called Valda Ravix who's in it, who's a big mover in the Lutheran Church in London, and she chose to read the whole of Jerry Springer the Opera as a kind of Christian allegory for forgiveness. Fair enough, you know. And also, we had a lot of support from religious people, you know. Now this is all over, and I've experienced the sharp end of what religious censorship and pressure groups mean. You know, I will be joining the BHA and the NSS and whatever, but I don't want to have to, occupy a dismissive position about people's beliefs, because I think that they are cultural. Like my wife-to-be is an Irish Catholic, and it's, you can't really separate those two things out. You know, you can't. It's not so much about belief as about a sense of identity.
I know what you mean, Charlie. I still slightly bridle at anti-Catholic sentiment, even though
anti-Catholic sentiment against the Irish is very much turned. Yeah. It's to do with English Protestant domination of the country, and so a lot of how people define themselves is in the background of their beliefs. You kind of think it's asking a lot of someone to abandon that because it's irrational when it is part of what makes you who you are, you know. And I think being brought up in the Church of England as I was to maximise educational opportunities is the nearest thing to being brought up thinking nothing, you know, because there's a high end of Anglicanism is just superbly vague. I mean, there's a thing in the paper now, isn't there, where I think it's in Cambridgeshire where the Church of England have allowed a former Christian vicar who is now a Hindu to retake up his position, because he says that they've now got a Hindu vicar, right? And he
says, have a similar parallel,
you see that story,
and
he said that he believes that we're all worshipping the same God, but it's like focused differently depending on the culture that you're in. Now, fair enough, but I would have thought, he is a Hindu. Like, what are they going to think?
There's a similar thing in Methodism. My background is it was in Methodism, and fairly recently, the Methodist Church sort of had one of their meetings decided that actually it'd be perfectly acceptable to be a Methodist and an atheist.
Yeah.
You know, that doesn't actually necessarily stop you believing in the tenets of Methodism.
I have great sympathy for the Archbishop of Canterbury. I think it's terrible that he's come down on the side of the anti-gay lobby in the Anglican Communion at the moment. But he's head of the Druid organisation, the honorary head of the Druid organisation. He's an incredible string band fan.
Yes, and that always impressed me.
And that takes a lot more commitment than being Archbishop of Canterbury, because a lot of the later albums are terrible, let's face it. But I never met him, but reading between the lines, I suspect that he doesn't necessarily believe in God, but he feels the best chance we have for a cohesive society is one based on the useful social metaphors that are in the Bible. But I think he's been forced into a more dogmatic position to hold the Anglican Communion together worldwide.
I think he has, yeah.
And I think a lot of them feel like that. I think that the Archbishop of Canterbury, as an incredible string band fan, I should imagine he responds poetically and artistically to the Bible rather than rationally. But he's been forced into a position where he's not allowed to make that distinction anymore due to the evangelical right, and he needs to keep them together because they need the rent, you know.
It really is as simple as that, I think. Yeah.
You know, they can't, economically, the Anglican Communion can't allow those people to shear off, so they're having to backtrack towards far more reactionary positions just out of economic necessity, you know. Mm. It seems to me, I don't know.
And as Padre was saying, you know, it's difficult when you're confronted with one sort of extreme reaction not to react and go the whole hog the other way.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about the atheists and humanists. It did make me think of this essay I read by Orwell, in which he was actually talking about the Labour Party and was saying, why can't we get more people in socialism in the 30s and the 20s, actually, was probably written. And he was saying, well, part of the problem is there's so many freaks in it. You know? It's like there's loads of weirdos and really off-putting, you know, he described them as sort of sandal-wearing beardy types, which was an astonishing thing to read from this time.
50 years before Blair made the same point. point about the 80s Labour Party.
And if you go to a lot of, you know, sparsely attended atheist and humanist meetings of the sort that, that Padraig and I go to, you know, there are always, inevitably, the groaning moments where somebody just stands up and has their usual rant about
something. Yeah, but the audience for free improvisation is largely the same. I mean, that's the other thing. I mean, you know, you kind of think this is with free improv, you think this is music at its most refined form. There's nothing to be scared of. Anyone could find something to enjoy about it, even if it's simply laughing at it. But you feel that the context for it is, it's become arcane, and it ought to be democratised in some way. And it's the same with, yeah, there's no loads of people. The majority of people in Britain are atheists and humanists. Mm-hmm. They just don't know it, and they're scared because the word atheist is, particularly in America, for example, is tantamount. It's like it's becoming a pejorative term.
Well, you know, there was a Gallup poll came out last week where atheists rate slightly, but only slightly, above Scientologists as the least popular belief group.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, even though I'm not technically even a belief group.
It's a non-belief group.
And there was an academic study done last year which actually came out even worse, where the least trusted, basically the person you'd least like your daughter to marry, would be an atheist.
Well, a friend of mine who's a Muslim comic, I get on very well with, Shazia Mirza. Yeah, another one of my religious friends. All right. She said she was... I realised talking to her once that because I was an atheist, she thought that meant I was a nihilist and that I had no moral code whatsoever.
Yeah.
Right.
And I had to kind of... We had to backtrack a bit because it was such an anathema to her. I mean, she, merely by discussing issues of her background on stage, she gets all sorts of death threats and nonsense. So I think it was quite sort of progressive, but even so, for her, it was an impossible position to conceive. It was like being, you know, she said that's nihilism, and it isn't. It's not. It's quite the opposite. In fact, you're forced to construct a moral code without a lot of simple things already in place for you to fall back on.
And it's, I think, in some ways, perhaps more coherent, more inculcated, because it's not based on fear of punishment.
Yeah.
What's that great phrase? It's life without invisible means of support.
It's lovely, that, isn't it?
I really like that one.
Yeah.
Well, Stuart, thank you very much for coming
in. Thanks for having us on.
Well, I think we'll have a drink in a minute, which would be nice. So, but just before we do disappear, the notices, I guess, I just wanted to mention, because it's something that's quite important to us and to the programme. There's a demonstration about Darfur tomorrow, which has been...
Sunday.
Oh, sorry, it is on Sunday. That was a good start. It's been organised by Amnesty International and the Aegis Trust. I suppose the best thing to do would be to tell you to go to the website, which is dayfordarfur.com, I think.
Org.
Thank you. I'm so glad you're here, Padre, to correct me on every single thing I've managed to say about this. And otherwise, it's meet outside the Sudanese embassy at 11 a.m. and wear a blue hat. It's basically, it's trying to urge some action from the United Nations. So it's not an invasion or any of the other things it's been incorrectly.
Oh, can I mention that I'm the funny turn on a benefit for Lowell Coxhill, the jazz musician who's got a bad hip, at the Red Rose on the 24th of September.
Oh, super. Good. I'm planning to go to that. Right. So I'll see you there.
Yeah, all right.
Well, you've been listening to Little Atoms. Thank you very much to Stuart. Thank you very much to Padraig. I'm going to take a few more weeks off, so you'll be back with Neil next time. Thanks a lot for listening. We'll be right back.